Hey, Corey here. We've had an influx of new listeners, and so I just want to make sure that if you are new to the podcast, you don't just jump in and start listening to these daily episodes, which we've been doing. Please go back and listen to the first at least 8 episodes so you have an idea of what Collapse is, what it is that Corey is talking about. Also, if you've been with us for a while and you're enjoying the content, please join us on Patreon. We would love to see you there. There's a link, as always, in the description. There are a lot of voices in the climate world and in the collapse world, and it's hard to know which ones to listen to. This is a theme that's come up several times over the course of the podcast, and it's this idea that there is a very wide range of ideas and thoughts around what the future is going to look like and the timing for that future. Since the beginning of time, there have been people declaring that the end is nigh, right? And these sort of doomsday predictions that are always just around the corner. Religious cults make money off of grifting, telling people that the world's about to end, so give us all your money. Individuals have made these claims, you know, whether that's to get their 15 minutes of fame or whatever it might be. But even amongst the more science-based, the more rational or trustworthy institutions, there's still a very wide range of beliefs. We've talked much in this podcast about especially the IPCC, scientific reticence, incorrect models, conservative models, and, you know, sort of the projections that those create. They often paint a dire picture, but much further off in the future than what would, cause a people to panic themselves into change immediately. Meanwhile, you have individuals who are scientists or claim to be scientists or just within the collapse sphere who make their own predictions. Some of those, again, on the more conservative side, some of those on the more epic or dramatic side. We've talked about people like Guy McPherson. I've expressed my disappointment in that side of the collapse sphere just in so much that it does a disservice, right, to make these bold and dire predictions mere years or a decade or less than a decade away that don't happen and drive people away, right? It gives people the excuse to say, these people are crazy and these people are wrong. I want to talk about today, James Hansen. Dr. Hansen seems to be right in the sweet spot. And I think that I agree wholeheartedly with his predictions. I think early on, I was nervous that his assumptions and his predictions, because they lay outside of the scientific consensus, that he may be more on the side of a Guy McPherson. But over time, and having done more and more research over the years, number one, we found that he's correct. He has been astonishingly correct up to this point, and he's been around for a long time. He was one of the first, the OGs who were, you know, declaring to Congress and to the world in 1988, that we were going to be experiencing these issues due to climate change. He has stayed remarkably consistent over that time. And while his predictions for future, or I should say projections for future temperatures are higher than what the IPCC claims, it seems like it is much more in line with reality. If I was new to the idea of collapse or just climate science in general, and I wanted to get a realistic picture of what I could expect in the future, I do think that Dr. James Hansen is a great resource to look towards. We did an article a while back about some research, some new studies that suggested that we could hit 3 degrees Celsius as early as the 2050s. Obviously, the IPCC and the Paris Climate Accords and all of those things were aiming at keeping us below 1.5 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. That research we spoke about back then, I think this was, what, maybe 6 weeks to 2 months ago, talked about this idea that we could potentially hit three degrees Celsius between 2050 and 2060 and hit 2 degrees Celsius before 2040. This is something that was previously not scientifically backed, right? It was something that people would say, but you might hear that and think, okay, you're being hyperbolic. There's not really any scientific backing. It's more based on vibes. Those vibes, it turns out, could very well be correct. And James Hansen has just released a blog with some new research confirming these dates. He puts the possibility of 2 degrees Celsius at an average date of 2037, 2.5 degrees Celsius just shy of 2050, and 3 degrees Celsius by or before 2060. I don't think that I need to remind you of the stark differences between 1.5 degrees, 2 degrees, and 3 degrees Celsius. Many people believe that 3 degrees Celsius is essentially a guaranteed collapse range and starts to get into uninhabitability range. So I'm going to read some bits from his blog. His blog post was titled, "Another El Nino Already? What Can We Learn From It?" And by the way, there are lots of people who are giving their commentary on this. One of those is Paul Beckwith. Paul Beckwith is another voice of reason, but of harsh reality that I trust. He does some great videos. I've talked about his videos many times on the podcast. I'll link to his discussion about this as well so that you can listen to his commentary. One of the main points here is that it's very rare to have two El Niños back-to-back like this in such rapid succession. Now, we don't know for sure that we will have an El Niño this year. It is not guaranteed, but it's looking more and more likely, and the probability. So the abstract of his paper says, "The world seems headed into another El Niño just 3 years after the last one. Such quick return normally would imply, at most, an El Niño of moderate strength. But we suggest that even a moderately strong El Niño may yield record global temperature already in 2026 and still greater temperature in 2027. The extreme warming will be a result mainly of high climate sensitivity and a recent increase of the net global climate forcing, not the result of an exceptional El Niño per se. We find that the principal drive for global warming acceleration began in about 2015, which implies that 2 degrees Celsius global warming is likely to be reached in the 2030s, not at mid-century." So there's a lot to hit on from this abstract, and I'm just going to touch through a couple of these points. So let's start at the end of the abstract, where he talks about how global warming acceleration began in about 2015. And they did an analysis on the rate of change in the climate in the years prior to 2015, and then obviously all the way up until today. And they found that at some point between 2010 and 2015, there began to be a shift where the amount of heat energy being introduced into the atmosphere, or just the amount of change, stopped being linear and shifted off of the linear path more towards an exponential path. So between 2010 and 2015, it was a relatively steady climb. Now, if we had even stayed at that steady climb, we would have major issues in the future because it was climbing, right? It was what the IPCC was projecting. We were going to be heading towards potentially 2 degrees Celsius by mid-century if we couldn't reverse things. But because of the change in 2015 and thereafter, and up until this point, there has now been that shift that means that those changes are more exponential. The amount of warming per decade has doubled. Previously, the amount of warming per decade was projected around 0.2 degrees Celsius, and now that rate is looking more like 0.4 degrees Celsius. If we are currently sitting on the long-term average of around 1.4 degrees Celsius or so, then over the course of the next decade at the current rate of warming, we would be likely around 1.8 degrees or so. That said, because this rate is increasing, it likely will not take longer than that decade to hit 2 degrees Celsius. And James Hansen et al. Believes that we will be hitting 2 degrees Celsius by 2037, or at some point in the 2030s. Now, there is something really important about this that I want to touch on, and I've tried to put this into words previously, and I think I've struggled a little bit, but I saw a commenter who put it in a way that I thought was really good. And it's the idea that we measure climate change over long-term averages, right? Even though we've had years above 1.5 and 1.6 degrees Celsius for the course of the entire year, we're not at 1.5 degrees Celsius yet because of that long-term average. We focus on that number a lot, and I think that it's less important than looking at the current year's numbers, or at least a shorter average, right? What are the last 3 years versus what are the last 20 years or last 30 years? When we talk about an exponential rate of change, the most recent years have an outweighed impact compared to the years 20 years ago or 30 years ago. Why are we measuring what happened 20 years ago? That doesn't change what is happening now. And so the wording from this comment I want to read went something like this. I'm going to read the whole comment. It says, the first time we recorded a single day above 1.5 degrees Celsius was a few days in December 2015. 9 years later, in 2024, was the first full year to exceed 1.5 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial average. Okay, so we went from, in 2015, having a single day above 1.5 degrees Celsius. 9 years later, 2024, we had a full year that was past 1.5 degrees Celsius. He said November 2023 was the first time we recorded a couple days above 2 degrees Celsius. If the same trend can be applied, then 2032 would be the full first year to exceed 2 degrees Celsius. Now, that's heavily just extrapolated, right? That's not necessarily the way we would look at that from a scientific perspective, but we'll take that for what it's worth. Now, the important part, it says, however, technically we might still be below the Paris limit, but that's only because it uses a long-term average over 20 to 30 years. And you know what? The natural world and how it responds won't give a shit about averages. You can have a chunk of ice sitting at negative 5 degrees Celsius for 20 years. If there's a spike to, say, 5 degrees Celsius the following year, the average temp will still be negative 4.5 degrees Celsius. But all the ice will be gone because now it's 5 degrees Celsius. So, yeah, it's this idea that, like, okay, well, the average is still negative 4.5, right? Which would tell us that the ice should still be there because the average temperature is so low, it's below freezing. And yet, none of that matters because this year, it's 5 degrees Celsius and it melted the ice. Now, you can apply that in all of the different ways to say, we've had this last year, or 2024, that was 1.5, 1.6 degrees above the baseline. We are starting to see impacts of a 1.5 or 1.6 degree world. By the time the IPCC or whoever does that measurement says, okay, over the long term, we've now hit 1.5 degrees Celsius, we're going to already be having years that are 2 degrees Celsius, and we'll be feeling the impacts of that warmth in that year. So anyway, going back to James Hansen's paper here, based on their data, they're expecting that we're going to hit 1.5 degrees Celsius formally over the long term at the end of this decade, the 2020s, 2 degrees Celsius by the end of the next decade, and potentially years before we hit the end of the decade, and 2.5 to 3 degrees Celsius then between 2048 and 2060. I'm going to read one more chunk from this blog. It says, we inferred that global temperature, after reaching a minimum about 1.4 degrees Celsius in the first half of 2026, will rise to about 1.7 degrees Celsius in the first half of 2027, as spurred by even a moderately strong El Niño. The graph, which is shown in his blog, begins in 1979 because upper 300-meter data only goes back that far, but the trend rates of global temperature and Niño 3.4 are nearly unchanged when their data begins in 1970. Global warming begins to diverge from the linear trend in 2015. The magnitude of this gap is the source of befuddlement for climate models, especially those with low climate sensitivity. This persistent, seemingly growing gap implies an increase of the net climate forcing. And that's what we talk about when we talk about this exponential growth. The net forcing, so the net amount of change in energy and heat in the atmosphere, is growing compared to the input. There are some answers to this, and there's much confusion about this, right? Some of the answers are that we've had a decrease in aerosols. Aerosols come from shipping and, you know, different emissions that are more short-term. Those aerosols only stay in the atmosphere for a much smaller amount of time, maybe a couple of years. And that when the amount of shipping decreases, like it did during COVID, the amount of aerosols in the atmosphere decrease. Those aerosols act to keep heat out. And so by removing those aerosols, we see an increase in the overall temperature and in net forcing. Moving on with what he said here in the blog, it says, if we characterize this forcing change with a single turning point, that turning point is in the range 2010 to 2015, probably closer to 2015. Thus, in finding the best linear fit to accelerated global warming in Figure 1, we show results with the linear fit starting on the trend line for both choices, 2010 and 2015. The latter more realistic choice results in global warming reaching 2 degrees Celsius in the 2030s. He says, the current flippant attitude that 1.5 degrees Celsius isn't so bad, we can deal with 3 degrees Celsius. So that current flippant attitude of people who should know better will dissolve. if we can improve understanding of the danger of passing the point of no returns. Yes, we know this all sounds very theoretical. That is the world we live in. Politicians cannot see past the end of their nose the next election. Young people understand that and have the potential to affect the future. It will be an interesting story. And indeed, an interesting story it shall be. They say that we live in fascinating times. You know, there's the old Lord of the Rings quote about interesting times. I do think it is mesmerizing, fascinating. There's many words to describe it, many of which are sad and depressing and overwhelming, but some of which, and I think for whatever reason, my brain is just geared to work this way, to view it as we're living in a time of history in which we're going to experience, we're going to see something truly original. We talk about the way that historians look back on a time in history, right, and try to dissect it and try to understand it. They pick it apart and pull it apart, and maybe one of the things that they say is, I wish I could have been there during that time to understand how it unfolded. I often think about how I wish I could go back in time and experience or witness something occurring in history. Well, we are here right now witnessing this point of humanity, this point of history. And while it's not fun and it's going to be full of suffering and pain and all of those things, none of which, you know, I look forward to. But all I can do is sort of embrace this moment and witness it. And that's much of what this podcast is about, is witnessing these moments, recording them as they pass, and sort of chronicling collapse as it happens. How the story unfolds next, you know, what's the next chapter? At what rate do things increase? James Hansen talks about it in this paper and says that we still have power to decide the trajectory. Maybe not as individuals, but we as a society, we as humanity are writing the next chapter of the book, are deciding how epically bad it's going to be. And every moment from here forward can change what that future trajectory looks like. The choices that are being made right now don't seem to be great ones. They don't seem to be moving us in the right direction. You know, they don't seem to be recalculating or reprojecting a new trajectory, one that might be less bad. The choices that we're making as a society are moving us more and more up and to the right on those heat charts. It's one of the biggest questions and ones that I don't have answers to, and I'm not sure if anyone really does, as to what we can do, those of us who care, those of us who are paying attention, those of us who understand what future this is going to lead to. What can we do to alter that trajectory? It feels powerless, right? And sometimes I have to tell myself, in order to not go completely insane, that I am powerless, that all I can do is my best to continue to live, to survive, to control what is in my small circle of influence, my family, my neighborhood, my community, my friends, and at the end of it all, to witness. All right. Thanks for being here.
Neulich bei der Versicherung.
Bahnhof.
Bahnhof. Bahnhof.
Bahnhof.
Bahnhof.
Bahnhof.
Bahnhof.
Bahnhof.
Bahnhof.
Bahnhof.
Bahnhof.
Bahnhof.
Bahnhof.
Bahnhof.
Sie verstehen bei Ihrem Berater nur Bahnhof? Zeit zu Ergo zu wechseln, denn da verstehen Sie nur.
Einfach.
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 Denn wir machen Versichern einfacher. Einfach, weil's wichtig ist. Ergo.
Hey, Corey here. If you are listening to the back catalog of Breaking Down Collapse, thank you. Those episodes are so vital. They're so important. But I also wanted to let you know that I am now doing daily episodes. Yes, that's right. Here on the podcast, daily episodes. So if you are enjoying the back catalog, great. Please also feel free to zoom forward to the most recent episodes. Catch us daily. They are quick little episodes, and I think you'll enjoy them. Thanks.